Plastic Cordelia, they're Yankee hams. Henry wondered why she couldn't seem to understand that. I think it's pretty likely they came from somewhere here in Virginia. That makes them Confederate hams, and we have more right to them than the Union soldiers do.
What she said made sense, Henry admitted, grudgingly, to himself, but he still didn't like the idea. He knew someone else who wouldn't like it either. As he gave the hams to Cordelia, he asked, "What are you going to tell Ma when she wants to know where these came from?" Cordelia looked stricken, and he realized she hadn't thought of that. If Abigail Brannon knew they were eating food that came from a Yankee, there would be hell to pay. As it turned out, Cordelia had to do something she didn't like to do. She lied to her mother. But it was only a little lie, she tried to convince herself.
"The bag came untied and slipped off some Yankee cavalryman's horse while he was riding by, but he didn't notice," Cordelia explained that evening to her mother. "Henry and I went out and got it when he was gone."
She looked across the table at her brother. She couldn't read the expression on his face. He just sat there solemnly, neither confirming nor denying her story. He had agreed not to reveal where the hams came from. Abigail and Louisa had been down in the root cellar that morning when Keller stopped by the farm, so they didn't know anything about his visit. When Cordelia spun her yarn about finding the hams, Abigail nodded in acceptance of the lie.
"If he was a Yankee, that means he stole these hams from some poor Southerner," she said. "It's only fitting that those thieving Northerners don't get to eat 'em. I feel sorry for whoever they were stolen from in the first place, though."
"I don't reckon we'll ever know," Henry said. That was his only comment on the matter. They carved a little meat from one of the hams, then hung the rest of it in the smokehouse with the other one. This unexpected bounty would have to last as long as possible. Cordelia was hungry when she went to bed that night, but her pangs weren't quite as bad as usual. Drifting off to sleep, she thought of Lieutenant Joseph Keller with gratitude. She thought as well of how polite he was, and even handsome, in a boyish, rough-hewn way. Those musings took her by surprise. She really hadn't given much consideration to any young man since Nathan Hatcher left Culpeper. Nathan had come close to breaking her heart with his refusal to embrace the Southern cause. Deserting the Confederacy to go and fight for the Union had been the final straw, the final nail in the coffin where their budding relationship was buried. Still, there were times when she missed him. The sound of his voice, the touch of his hand, the taste of his kisses they had shared so briefly. She was a healthy young woman, and she enjoyed the company of young men other than her brothers. These days, though, Henry was the only male around. "Damn Nathan anyway," she thought, then swiftly recanted. She knew from what Titus had said when he returned that Nathan had been in the Yankee prison camp with him. The Union authorities were convinced, for some unknown reason, that Nathan was a rebel, not the federal infantryman he claimed to be, and actually was, until he was captured by the Yankees while wearing Confederate gray at Fredericksburg. Cordelia had no way of knowing if Nathan was alive or dead now. She prayed that he was alive. He had been her friend, and for that reason he would always be special to her. Joseph Keller now was another story. She didn't know what to make of him. But she wished futilely that an image of his face had not been floating in her mind as she slipped into a thankfully dreamless slumber. Over the next couple of weeks, Keller made several excuses to visit the Brannon farm. Considering the colonel's animosity toward Henry Brannon, Keller didn't really need an excuse. Avery had commanded that the family be watched. If anyone questioned Keller about his activities, he would answer that he was just following the colonel's orders. It was quiet here behind the lines. That left Keller with mixed emotions. Elsewhere in Virginia, the Army of the Potomac was bogged down in the trenches in front of Petersburg, but at least those men were seeing some action on occasion. In the Shenandoah Valley, across the Blue Ridge Mountains, battles and skirmishes took place almost daily, as General Phil Sheridan tried to rid the valley of Confederate Rangers. Down in Georgia, General William Tecumseh Sherman had captured the vital city of Atlanta and had the rebels on the run, some of them retreating northwestward into Tennessee, while the rest of that part of the Confederate army fled toward the sea. It was only a matter of time until Sherman went after one group or the other. Or both. Nearly every day, Keller heard the other junior officers discussing these developments in the war. Eagerly, they debated strategy and laid out the glorious battle plans they would implement if they were in charge, instead of Grant, Meade, Sherman, and Sheridan. Flasks and bottles were passed around in the parlors of commandeered houses, and the confident laughter flowed as easily as did the whiskey. The Confederacy was beaten. That was the general consensus. Oh, the rebels might hang on stubbornly for a while yet, but they had no real hope of winning. That had been gone for a long time. Now, any thoughts the Confederate leaders might have had about negotiating a peace that would leave them with their new government intact were slipping away as well. Still, much hinged on the upcoming presidential election. For a time, it had looked as if old Honest Abe might not be reelected. If that happened, the peace parties in both North and South would have the opening they hoped for. A chance to drive a wedge between the supporters of the war and present their own plans for a peace treaty. But if Lincoln won, the appeasers would be denied their chance. Only a total victory would satisfy the president and end the war. Keller hoped that would be the case. A negotiated peace sounded wonderful, in theory. Many on both sides just wanted the killing to stop, no matter what the cost. But if that happened, if a treaty were put in place that would allow the Confederacy to continue to exist, even in an altered, weakened form, then they would just have to fight this war all over again in another 10 or 20 years, Keller believed. And if that came about, the country might be so divided that it could never be reunited again, if that wasn't the case already. Political theorizing aside, Keller shared his fellow officers' conviction that the war would be over soon, one way or another. So far, he had never been any closer to combat than hearing the dull roar of artillery in the distance. He had missed Antietam, missed Gettysburg, missed all the opportunities for a man to cover himself with military glory. When he enlisted, he never would have dreamed that such a thing could ever be important to him. He wanted to do his part to help win the war for the Union, of course, but more than that, he wanted to get through it and return to the Ohio Academy, where he taught history and philosophy. He had been teaching there for only a year when the rebel guns fired on Fort Sumter. His career had barely begun, and he was anxious to resume it, or so he thought. Now he considered the possibility that the great conflict would end before he had the chance to prove himself in battle, and he felt discomfort go through him. Discomfort, and even some unwarranted, he told himself, shame. He had nothing to be embarrassed about. He had been a good soldier, always following orders, always doing his best. But the real demands on him had been slight. With all that weighing on his mind, it was a wonder he had any room in his brain for anything else, let alone for the thoughts he had been having since his first visit to the Brennan farm. Since he had first laid eyes on a young woman with masses of red hair that tumbled about her shoulders, skin the color of cream that he knew would be incredibly smooth to the touch, and the most compelling green eyes he had ever seen. In his tent at night, Keller felt himself growing warm with mingled embarrassment and desire when he thought about Cordelia Brennan. His parents had raised him to be a proper gentleman, so it bothered him when his more human nature asserted itself. Cordelia was a lady. Oh, not one of those southern belles he had heard about. The ones who sat around the parlors in their great plantation houses, fanning themselves languidly, while they were waited on hand and foot by kowtowing darkies. Cordelia wasn't like that at all. For one thing, the Brennans didn't have a plantation house, or any slaves. And for another, Cordelia was the sort of woman who was accustomed to hard work, yet she had never lost her gentle, beautiful spirit. Keller could tell that just by looking at her. He was smitten, no doubt about that. But he told himself that wasn't the real reason he paid so many visits to the Brennan farm. Nor were his feelings for Cordelia what prompted him to bring them whatever supplies he could get his hands on without drawing attention to himself. He was just trying to be a fair, conscientious soldier. The first time he went back to the farm, he brought a small pouch full of flour with him. It was barely enough to make a batch of biscuits, but he knew it was probably more than the Brannons had seen in a while.